Welcome to Spotlight. Iranians across the country have turned out to mark the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. People from all walks of life participated in the rallies to mark the revolution that was led by the late Imam Khomeini that toppled the Western-backed Pahlavi regime. In fact, the revolution brought the curtain down on more than two millennia of monarchy in the country. The 1979 Islamic Revolution was meant to fulfill the long-cherished desire of independence for Iranians who had suffered decades of subjugation and domination by a monarchical rule with the backing of some foreign powers, especially the U.S. and the U.K. One of the revolution's main promises was to keep the country away from all forms of dependence, either on the West or the East. On tonight's program, we'll explore the many achievements of Iran's Islamic Revolution.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars, and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus pandemic, waving flags of Iran and banners in support of their country.
I'm 15 years old. I'm here as a young adult to say that we don't care what the enemies are saying against the Islamic Revolution. We are here to show our support for our leader and our country.
I'm 43 years old as the Islamic Revolution. I'm here to voice my support for the Islamic establishment. When we see people are taking part in rallies across the country, it means that we have security and tranquility. Accordingly, we are here to honor the blood of our martyrs and celebrate our day of independence.
Speaking on the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said the country's foreign policy relies on balance and progress hinges on unity and convergence, and Iran does not pin hope on the West.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan, from the east to the west, north and south of the country. We have no hope in Vienna and New York.
In a statement at the end of the events, the demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country.
Analysts believe that after 43 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic Revolution, Iran has currently been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom-seeking and the oppressed nations of the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Joining us on Spotlight, we have political commentator Tohid Asadi, who's joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. And also we have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who's joining us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
General, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Asadi in Tehran. One of the main goals of the Islamic Revolution was establishing political independence. Was that goal achieved, and has it been maintained over the past four decades, in your opinion?
Well, for a lot of people, the Islamic Revolution has got a religious connotation, but I think the most outstanding privilege and possession of the revolution is the sense of coherence that it created and the sense of unitedness that kind of united all the people and gathered them together under one flag. And that is, I think, the most significant outcome of this revolution. But in addition to that, I think independence is a key point of concern from the very early days of the revolution. And the country has tried under the Islamic Revolution to establish an independent sovereign system when it comes to its domestic affairs and when it comes to its foreign affairs. And we can take it almost for granted that the revolution was kind of response to the status quo under Shah regime under which the country was not able to make slightest decisions without the green light of the United States and the West. So people were, on that period of time, very much aware of how the country was in an urgent need for an independent system. And the revolutionary, let's say, people and actually the elites on that period of time decided to stand against a totally dependent system, to develop a totally independent system. And I think if you just take a look at these more than four decades of the Islamic Revolution's history, even though there are some deficiencies, what outstands and what tops the list of priorities of the country has been the independence. And this independence has got basically two definitions. One is related to the domestic affairs. As I told you before, almost every decision made inside the country was kind of related or under influence of foreign determinants. But after the revolution, the country took a trajectory in which all the domestic affairs were decided based upon the consensus and a democratic process taking place inside the country. So no driving force coming from outside the country could actually pave any way for the formulation of key issues inside the country. And the second point is related to the independence of Iran's foreign policy, which again during the era of Iran's Shah, almost every decision related to the foreign policy of the country was met under influence of the United States and its Western allies.
Right.
Just one sentence to add, if I may.
Sure.
And after the revolution, perhaps the very outstanding realization of the new course of action to be taken was, again, an independent course of action in Iran's foreign policy pertaining to the region, pertaining to the international community, and all the related affairs.
Richard Becker, Iran's military deterrence, it's quite a force in Western Asia. And what makes it even more impressive is that it's indigenously manufactured and domestically built. How significant is this amidst the four decades of sanctions that the Islamic Republic has endured?
Well, I think it's very significant. There are really a limited number of countries in the world which are able to, say, produce cars and produce many other goods like the larger type consumer goods as well as military goods. I think that if we look at in context, what's happened over the last 70 years, that there was the first attempt by Iran to break free from Western domination, British, and particularly British and also U.S. domination in the early 1950s with the Mossadegh government. And the U.S. put sanctions on it, and of course the British did too, and set out and largely succeeded in preventing Iran from trading oil, its main resource and main source of foreign earnings. And then based on that, there was destabilization and the intervention by the CIA and British intelligence, and the government was overthrown. So now we've seen another similar pattern where there's been a blockade, really, an embargo of through the sanctions of Iranian trade over the last several years since the JCPOA agreement was abrogated unilaterally by the United States. But there's no possibility that the Iranian government today is going to be overthrown in the way that the Mossadegh government was. So I think that we see there's been a big change. I mean, it's a change that's been a change in the world. That's one point, a very big change. And so the countries that the U.S. has targeted with sanctions now are not being overthrown, and that reflects that change. At the same time, we can see that the United States policy in regard to countries that have had revolutions, countries that were U.S. dependencies, the U.S. government has been very unforgiving. The U.S. ruling elite have been unforgiving in their implementation of sanctions, of blockades against, and regardless of what the form of the government is, whether it's a socialist government like in Cuba, or the Islamic Republic in Iran, or the government in Venezuela, any country that breaks away from the United States domination and seeks to find an independent path finds itself targeted by Washington with these kind of really what are really forms of economic warfare, the sanctions I'm speaking about, and other forms of economic intervention to prevent Iran from being able to trade and to engage in normal relations, economic relations with other countries. But again, while that targeting is clearly there, it's not succeeding this time around.
Tohidas Adi, amidst all the hurdles and hindrances and sanctions, the Islamic Republic has managed to overcome all the obstacles and the difficulties. What does that say about its longevity?
Well, just to follow up what your other guest correctly mentioned, I think there is no small spot of hesitation that the United States has started to take a hostile, rancorous approach pertaining to the Islamic Republic from the very earliest days of the revolution, and it includes a wide spectrum of tools in the toolbox of the Americans in order to confront and, let's say, go against the Islamic Revolution. And to tell you the truth, this wide range of tools does not know any limits when it comes to humanitarian issues, when it comes to the very ordinary citizens. And the United States has proved that it is the country that knows no limits when it comes to putting a kind of maximum pressure upon Iran. So in the past four decades, when it comes to Iran's defense capabilities, we have observed the same pressure directed from Washington against Iran when it comes to Iran's regional foreign policies, that it would be dancing with the same old tune. When it comes to Iran's nuclear peaceful program, it's almost the same, and we see the same hostile approach. And last but not the least, during the pandemic, what we saw was the very fact that the United States started to make some obstacles when Iran tried to import some medication. And I'm not, this is not a theoretical conversation. We have seen and observed so many sanctions against some pharmaceutical companies in Iran in order for not make them able to import some things, some pharmaceutical productions required for making medicine for ordinary people. And again, this toolbox includes covert actions by CIA, includes toughest sanctions, includes withdrawal from United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this is, you know, the list is abundant. So many examples comes to my mind. Just getting back to the history when Iraq invaded Iran, we saw that the United States had its full-fledged support by providing Saddam's regime with weapons of mass destruction used against Iranian ordinary people. And the list goes on and on and on. And you see, this is just not one or two instances, but it's a very whole picture in which there are different segments of this puzzle. And if you just take a look at it from a holistic perspective, you will see that this is not a tactic, this is not a policy, but this is a grand strategy that includes almost every possible tool, legal or illegal, in order to put pressure against Iran. And that is, I think, the price that you have to pay if you decide to go against a global tyrannical regime that exists in Washington.
Sure. Richard Becker, a guest that we spoke to here on our channel a while back said that we could be seeing the dawn of a new phase of unity in the Eurasian region, given further cooperation between the likes of Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing. Also, given that Iran is an integral part of this quote-unquote new dawn with its Look to the East initiative that was instigated by the government of President Ebrahim Raisi. Do you see it in that light as well, especially with the ugly exit? I can't find a better word for that, the ugly exit of the U.S. from Afghanistan.
Yes, it would appear to be that is what is happening. And I think it's being spurred on by the aggressiveness of Washington, both in fomenting this crisis in regard to Ukraine and fomenting the pivot to Asia that was announced first by Obama, continued by Trump, and now being continued by Biden, of this immense military buildup that's happening in that area. There's the sanctions that are taking place and really the surrounding of Iran with U.S. military bases. And all the time for here in the United States, we're presented with the propaganda that says those countries are the aggressors. There was even, you know, a cartoon a while back, quite well known, that had a picture of the bases surrounding Iran with the caption, Iran wants war. Look how close they put their country to our bases. And that's the kind of the incredible hypocrisy and cynicism of having this immense military buildup. This year, the largest U.S. military budget in history, largest Pentagon budget in history, and yet trying to focus the attention of people in the United States around a very false narrative that is designed to win support for these warlike policies. It's quite dangerous. I mean, even today or yesterday, we have Senator Bernie Sanders in Congress, in the Senate, one of the few people who will say this, but really warning of the drumbeats of war. And the coming together of Russia and China, Iran, and other states through the Belt and Road and through other agreements that are being made is viewed in Washington as a threat, not a military threat, not that those countries are about to attack the United States, but a threat to what is the central plank of U.S. foreign policy, the central doctrine, which says that there must be one superpower in the world and only one, and that superpower must be the United States. And so presents to the people in the United States and the people of the world that somehow we are all in competition, some grave competition with each other. But that's really more of the propaganda designed mm-hmm. to really justify a policy that's unjustifiable.
Tawhid Assadi, how do you rate the influence of the Islamic Revolution in the region and also in other parts of the world, in the Middle East, and in the Muslim world, particularly in its early years? The Islamic Revolution triggered enormous enthusiasm and redoubled opposition to a Western intervention and influence. Tell us more, please.
I would like to begin with a quick follow-up to what your previous guest mentioned, and that is a reference to the concept of Iranophobia as an inseparable segment of United States foreign policy pertaining to the Middle East. Of course, this comes from basically two roots. That is, first one is the Iran's kind of posture against the superiority of U.S. hegemony and so-called the status of it being a superpower. And then the second one comes from this concept of military-industrial complex. Let's not forget the fact that there is this huge amount of money that goes to the pockets of the United States by giving a highly tenuous picture of the Middle East and claiming that Iran is a country that destabilizes the region, it's, I think, an unimaginable amount of money that comes from this sense of instability that the United States tries to create in a very wrong way. But I think, in just getting back to your question, I think the countries in the region now, they are, and maybe after four decades, they are coming to this realization that if they're looking for a stabilized, peaceful region, it is not something to purchase, and it's not something to purchase from a country far, far away from the region. So the first point that the first conclusion that regional countries could gain from the Islamic Revolution is that independence, even if when it comes to security, it is not something that you can purchase from outside. And the Islamic Republic of Iran is a good instance showing that if you just rely on your own capabilities, then you can be independent in terms of security and in terms of defense capabilities. But, and one more point is the ray of hope that the Islamic Revolution created, not only among the Muslim community, but also among the community of oppressed people all over the world, so elsewhere here in the Middle East or other countries. And this is the very notion that Imam Khomeini and other revolutionary leaders created in the mindset of the oppressed people, that yes, there is a possibility to stand against the tyrannical regimes and to stand against the oppressors and create a totally new system on which the basis of decisions, the basis of, right, let's say, whole structure is independence, and it's to pay respect to every individual in the society.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Time has gotten the best of us. We have to bring this segment of the program to an end. Political commentator Tuaid Asadi from Tehran and Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. Thank you for contributing to the Spotlight. I'd also like to thank our guests for staying with us on tonight's show. It's good night for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. The day they see the angels, no good tidings will there be that day for the criminals. And the angels will say, prevented and inaccessible.
The 22nd verse of the chapter says,
يَوْمَ يَرَوْنَ الْمَلَائِكَةَ لَا بُشْرَى يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلْمُجْرِمِينَ وَيَقُولُونَ حِجْرًا مَحْجُورًا.
On the day when they shall see the angels, there shall be no glad tidings that day for the guilty. And they shall say, it is a forbidden thing, totally prohibited. Dear listeners, in the previous verse, you may remember that we talked about the arrogant people of the world and hereafter. They had no hope of resurrection and they expected to see angels. And now this verse is going to answer them. This verse will say that there will be angels coming to them as they wanted it, but in another form. But instead of conveying the light of revelation to them, they will declare the severest threats to them. يَوْمَ يَرَوْنَ الْمَلَائِكَةِ. Remember that day when they shall see the angels. لَا بُشْرَى يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلْمُجْرِمِينَ. There shall be no glad tidings that day for the guilty. That day, as Imam Baqir alayhi salam says, is the day of their death, and Allah orders the angel of death to take their life, and when their soul is going to leave their body, some angels hit their backs and faces. Then Imam Baqir alayhi salam recited this verse, يَوْمَ يَرَوْنَ الْمَلَائِكَةَ لَا بُشْرَى يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلْمُجْرِمِينَ.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
So this noble verse is a kind of threat and warning that they want to see the angels. They wanted to see the angels in the world bringing revelation to them. And they will finally see the angels, these
arrogant ones, these polytheists or unbelievers, but as the verse says, they will see them finally in another form, not in the situation they wanted, not while bringing them the light of revelation. لا بشرى يومئذ للمجرمين. There shall be no glad tidings that day for the guilty. On that day, they do not get happy. But since they see the signs of punishment along with them, they fear so much that they will utter the same sentence that they used to say at the time of danger in this world. The Holy Quran in chapter Ghafir says, وقال الذين في النار لخزنة جهنم ادعوا ربكم يخفف عنا يوما من العذاب. O Lord, grant grace to us. O Lord, exempt us. But this is what they were used to say at the time of danger in the world. Certainly, neither this sentence nor other sentences and requests will have any effect on their doomed fate, because they were the ones who started the fire by themselves, by their misdeeds in the world. And this very fire will burn them. The evil deeds which they have done in the world, the evil deeds which they have brought with them to this world, will be materialized before their eyes, and they will realize the consequences of their misdeeds. The verse continues saying, وَيَقُولُونَ حِجْرًا مَحْجُورًا. And the angels shall say, حِجْرًا مَحْجُورًا. Paradise is forbidden, totally prohibited. Hijran mahjura. The Arabic word hijr originally means an area that is furnished with stones, and it becomes forbidden to enter. If we see that Hijr Ismail is called hijr, it is because it prevents man from some evil actions. That is why we read in the fifth verse of chapter Fajr, هل في ذلك قسم لذي حجر. Is there not in this an oath for those who have sense? Also, the companions of Hijr, whose name is mentioned in the Holy Quran, has been used for the name of the people of Salih, alayhi salam, who used to make fortified stone houses for themselves in the mountains, and they were protected by those houses. Brothers and sisters, we will, God willing, talk about the rest of the verse in the next program. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
France has totally rejected a legal request for the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner, Georges Ibrahim Abdallah, who is known as the Arab Nelson Mandela. In 1982, Israel had invaded Lebanon yet again. Abdullah's resistance group accepted responsibility for the deaths of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris, saying they were the legitimate acts of self-defense of a country under foreign invasion. Abdullah's trial was noted for its lack of proof, and his own lawyer later confessed to secretly working for the government. Ultimately, it seems that France has inaccurately classified Abdallah not as a soldier, but as a common criminal. There have been favorable court decisions for Abdallah over the decades, but governmental interference has not allowed them to be implemented or respected. If France refuses to let their courts release Abdallah, then it seems they are intent on forcing him to die in jail, and in a country which prides itself on having abolished the death penalty a few decades ago. Abdallah refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and many believe that's a primary reason why he hasn't been released.
George is a fighter. He'll have no problem with this latest injustice. After 37 years of harassment, bullying, and humiliation, he is well aware that the deck is stacked against him. George maintains a vast global correspondence despite his imprisonment, and he still lives for the movement of anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics.
The fight for the liberation of George Abdallah has gone from total obscurity to becoming an international cause, with anti-French protests recently held in North Africa, Lebanon, and even Latin America. Demonstrators say that they and Abdallah's supporters worldwide will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gehli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also accepted colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution. As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here, and they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, Supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars, and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus pandemic, waving flags of Iran and banners in support of their country.
I'm 15 years old. I'm here as a young adult to say that we don't care what the enemies are saying against the Islamic Revolution. We are here to show our support for our leader and our country.
I'm 43 years old, as old as the Islamic Revolution. I'm here to voice my support for the Islamic establishment. When we see people are taking part in rallies across the country, it means that we have security and tranquility. Accordingly, we are here to honor the blood of our martyrs and celebrate our day of independence.
Speaking on the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said the country's foreign policy relies on balance and progress hinges on unity and convergence, and Iran does not pin hope on the West.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan, from the east to the west, north and south of the country. We have no hope in Vienna and New York.
In a statement at the end of the events, the demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country.
Analysts believe that after 43 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic Revolution, Iran has currently been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom-seeking and the oppressed nations of the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A number of road haulage associations warned on Wednesday that lorry drivers won't take it anymore and are ready to go on the warpath as petrol, diesel and methane prices continue to surge dramatically in Italy. Higher fuel prices and household energy bills have further swelled living costs for people in Italy, with lorry drivers being among the hardest hit. Fuel prices overall in Italy are now at the highest since 2012. Petrol has gone up in price by almost 20% over the past 12 months, meaning it now costs an average over 9,000 euros more per month for a lorry driver to fill up.
We have sent the government an alert about the rising level of dissatisfaction among lorry drivers as they simply can no longer cover the costs. Drivers are now holding meetings autonomously in several Italian cities, and protests will be staged soon. They are demanding lower gas prices as well as reductions in taxes and tolls.
Lorry driving is the leading form of freight transportation in Italy, as 85% of all goods are shipped by road in the country. That's compared to a European average of about 70%. However, over the past years, Italian lorry drivers have seen their workload significantly decreasing as Eastern European haulers have surged into the Italian market.
As a result of lower labor costs, a growing number of Eastern European haulers have entered the Italian commercial transport system, thus leaving Italian lorry drivers fewer opportunities. Another reason behind this progressive reduction in competitiveness is the high excise duties we pay for fuel in Italy.
Italian lorry drivers have staged protests on several occasions over the past years, blockading major ports, borders and the main routes into Italy's cities. Road haulage associations are slated to meet with the government on February 17 in a final attempt to ease the simmering tensions. Max Civili, Rome.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us
you know, it boosts our morale and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable. It's possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was, a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socio-economic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and all the like, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have travelled to the United States, Ukraine and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting one of the major oil shows in the country. The Ahwaz Oil Exhibition brought together 210 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are in the list of U.S. sanctions.
One of our major products is the two-phase flow pump, which is a vital piece in the oil exploration process. We used to be dependent on foreign supply of this equipment, and due to the sanctions, it was really hard to access it. So we decided to rely on our domestic expertise, and we now build two-phase pumps locally. We also specialize in the production and execution of all kinds of offshore oil rigs from A to Z.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But Washington's oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how, to build this needed machinery, including drilling bits. And the result is beyond expectation.
Because of the sanctions, the oil industrial companies could not, you know, import these very important drilling rigs. So in these years, we made more than 300 drilling bits and PDC bits. And we made it, you know, we manufacture it domestically. And we think that we can continue, you know, manufacturing all of the needs of Iran.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 deal and the reimposition of sanctions the same year. Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts here say this would be another turning point in the oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the blows of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Ahvaz.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the prime minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the prime minister's shake-up at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's being driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour, asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
And this is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as prime minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Saipur is up, London.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now, because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms. Because we are under occupation, Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In the limelight.
Neither East nor West, but an Islamic Republic. This famous slogan encapsulated the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and its fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, in a world sharply polarized along the East-West divide. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Alireza Hashemi and has been taken from Press TV's website. The piece is titled How the 1979 Islamic Revolution Freed Iran from Great Power Tutelage. Neither East nor West, but an Islamic Republic. This famous slogan encapsulated the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran, with its fervent opposition to Cold War rivals, the United States and the Soviet Union, in a world sharply polarized along the East-West divide. The slogan was inspired by ideas of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who blamed the two powers for many problems of Iran and the Islamic world. Imam Khomeini believed Muslims should reject the influence of both capitalism and communism. Imam Khomeini said, "We're neither Eastern nor Western. We neither want this nor that. And we have a fight with nobody. And we'll have relations with anybody who is at peace with us and accepts us living independently. And we don't want relations with anybody who doesn't accept that." In the days of the Islamic Revolution, many Iranians were tired of decades of exploitation that led to Iran losing big parts of its land and hoped the upheaval would finally bring them independence. Their collective memory remembered that in the two world wars, the British and the Russian empires occupied their country and exploited them economically. Also etched into the Iranian people's psyche was how the United States and Britain absorbed their democratic aspirations in 1953 by orchestrating a coup d'etat against the popular government and returning the autocratic Shah to the throne. The coup d'etat consolidated the West's imperialist domination over Iran for a quarter of a century. In the 1970s, the Pahlavi regime was cheered on by then US President Richard Nixon as one of America's cops on the beat in the Middle East, helping steer the oil-rich region away from the Soviet Union. In those days, the Pahlavi regime even obeyed the US request to support its much-criticized war in Vietnam, sending warplanes, hosting American forces, and giving them jet fuel. Henry Kissinger, the U.S. Secretary of State under Richard Nixon, admitted